Happy St. Patrick's Day to you. I'm Kathleen Dunn. I don't know what's on your playlist, but I always play Belfast-born Van Morrison during the course of the day, along with the Chieftains, along with the Clancy Brothers, along with many Irish musicians, because, of course, the land is known for music. The land is also known for people who know how to speak, and we are delighted to have Tipperary-born Frank Delaney with us again today. Scott Simon called him the most eloquent man in the world. He's an international best-selling author. He wrote a series of novels that trace Ireland, really during the whole of the 20th century, but mention what happened in Ireland centuries before, the first of which is Ireland, which was his first book written in America. He's also been a broadcaster. He covered the troubles in the North for 5 years. He's a screenwriter, a playwright, a judge of many literary prizes. He's created documentaries on Joyce Shaw, Oscar Wilde, Emily Dickinson, Robert Frost, Hemingway, Mailer, Matisse, Van Gogh. His BBC show On the Way We Speak, Word of Mouth, is still heard. And he has a six-part series, The Celts, which is still in active DVD distribution. And for all of you Ulysses lovers, his podcast, which examines James Joyce's Ulysses line by line in a five-minute podcast. This is a 25-year project. It's remarkable. It's been downloaded now by over 1 million people. Frank is with us this hour as we celebrate St. Patrick's Day. We'll also hear some poetry and some music, and we welcome your phone calls with St. Patrick's Day greetings, or perhaps you have a favorite poet you would like to talk about, or a piece of literature. Frank has recommendations of the 10 best top Irish novels. We'll give that during the course of this hour. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Frank. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Kathleen, I can't believe it's been a year.
I know, Frank. I'm so glad you're here again this year.
Where is the time going?
I know.
We're getting younger.
Yeah, that's the problem. You get older and it just goes by so quickly.
Speak for yourself. I'm getting younger every year.
Thank you. Well, I'll have to learn how you do that, and then maybe I can do the same thing. So what will you do today, Frank, other than be on the radio? Are you in much demand?
I'm in hiding.
Are you really?
Kind of. Some years ago, I wrote a poem for NPR on my complaints about St. Patrick's Day.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that St. Patrick's Day seemed to be celebrated by a lot of people who weren't Irish.
Yes.
And who seemed to think that the Irish spend all their time drinking in the street.
I know.
And I wrote a poem attacking this, and it didn't prove too popular.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you wrote that, because it has become, in so many ways, pretty obnoxious.
I'm told it's toning down.
Really?
So I've heard.
Oh.
So I hope that's the case. And if so, I will completely claim the credit for it, naturally enough.
And we'll give you the credit for it. Well, it's we probably celebrate in much the same way. I usually have a really nice dinner, but my family is all out at baseball spring training, so it's
just the
dog in me. But the dog is Irish, so
that's okay.
I know.
I hope he's an Irish setter or an Irish wolfhound or something.
He's a Wheaton Terrier.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
If he was a mutt, of course, I would have said he wasn't Irish at all, because we're a very purebred race.
Right, absolutely. So I read poetry and listen to music and do that.
Lovely way of spending the day.
It is, I think. Lovely way. Well, I want to start, I think, and we'll go back to him, but I want to start with James Joyce, because you hit over 1 million on the podcast.
I simply don't get it, Kathleen. It's being downloaded at the rate of 1,200 a day.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm getting emails all the time. I'm getting donations all the time. I get a lot of donations. People are immensely kind. This is not college students. This is people all over the world. Uzbekistan, Algeria.
No.
Cyprus, Greece, the west coast of the United States, all over the United States, Mexico. People, 22,000 in Australia.
Oh, my goodness.
Because you can now track all these things on the Internet. And this is what I think it is. Joyce himself was a small-D Democrat, and he believed in total democratization. He did, however, want to confuse the professors. But he said this book was for everybody. And what I'm doing is I'm expanding, opening out every single reference in it that gave the book the reputation of being obscure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm refusing to accept the reputation of obscurity, and I'm telling everybody this is what this book is like.
Mm.
And people are having a great time with it. And there's a kind of I don't want to use the word gratitude because that makes me sound like a great guy. But do you know what I mean? There's a kind of mood surrounding these podcasts where people are delighted. Then the podcasts have serious intent, but there's a lot of humor in them.
Mm-hmm.
They're deliberately meant to remove the obscurity. There's no concession whatsoever. Somebody described them recently. Somebody writing about them said that there's no concession. There's no dumbing down.
Right.
No lack of intellectual rigor here. But at the same time, there's nothing in any of them, he said, that a 14-year-old couldn't understand.
Oh, I'm so glad it's doing so well. And you, I was looking at your list of top 10 Irish novels over the weekend, and you put Ulysses as number one.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
It has to be first, you say.
Well, it's a love story, basically. Mm-hmm. It really is a love story. It's the story of human anguish. It's the story of a man who's desperate for a father, finding a father figure. It's the story of a man who loves his wife and has to stand by while she takes a lover. It's a story of heartbreak. It's very, very funny. It's a story of great thoughtfulness. There was an old tabloid in England. One of the tabloids Rupert Murdoch had to close down when this phone hacking scandal started in London was the News of the World. And the old masthead of the News of the World used to say, all human life is there. Well, all human life is there in this particular novel as well. And anybody who manages it, and that's why I'm so pleased that people are managing it afresh, anybody who manages it has a lovely time with it. Mm. It's a sweet, darling book once you crack the code.
Mm-hmm. And we want to tell everybody that Frank Delaney's, if you want to celebrate St. Patrick's Day, you go to Frank Delaney's website because you can find the podcast and so much more. He's the way you should celebrate St. Patrick's Day, which is why we have him on with us. But it's frankdelaney.com. Do you miss Ireland on a day like today?
I miss Ireland on a frosty day when there's no cloud.
Mm.
And when it's a great day to go for a long walk. I miss Ireland at 6:30 on a summer morning when there's nobody around and there's total silence. I remember going out to the Skellygrock. There are two mountain peaks that rise out of the sea on the southwest coast of Ireland, and they're called the Skellygrocks. And on top of one of them, there's a 6th-century monastery, uninhabited now, little beehive cells in it. I was up there one morning. It's 530 steps to climb up. I was up there one morning at dawn years ago. I had a tape recorder with me, and there was no sound. The needle on the tape recorder didn't move until a lark in the grass a few yards ahead of me started up.
Oh.
I miss Ireland then. I miss Ireland on summer nights at 10:30. I live in New York and Connecticut, as you know, Kathleen.
Yes.
And it's dark here in the evenings at 8:30, 9:00. I can't believe it. You know, in Ireland, when I grew up in Ireland, it's 10:30, 11:00 at nighttime. It's still daylight.
Hmm.
I miss Ireland then. But I love America.
Yeah. Well, you should. You just gave us a poem when you talked about going up to the monastery and not hearing the sound and hearing the lark. You need to write a poem today about it. That's beautiful.
Kind of. It was one of the moments that I will never forget in my life.
Hmm.
I was there making a documentary about the fact that there had been an ancient monastery there. And there was a very famous BBC series called Civilization, and Sir Kenneth Clarke, who presented
Yes,
it.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. When he began on the Skelligs, he said, this is where Western civilization clung on by its fingernails.
Huh.
These fisher monks kept the light of learning alive in this tiny little beehive cell monastery.
Mm.
And I went up there, as I say, this morning at, 5:30 in the morning as dawn was breaking, and there was not a sound.
Mm.
It was as if time had not elapsed at all.
Mm-hmm.
At any moment, you would expect to see one of the monks coming out of one of his cells.
Mm.
It was just timeless. And that's the thing that people find often when they go to Ireland. A lot of my friends here in the States say, we're going to go to Ireland. Do you have a route you can plan for us? Where should we go? Where should we stay? So on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come back, and I send them to various places, when they come back, they often mention this dimension of time to me. It's as though time stood still. Because here is this rocky island out on what the French call the Façade Atlantique, the Atlantic face. It's 33,000 square miles. It would fit into most American states, into some of them several times.
Right.
But in, for example, to Colorado 5 times.
Mm.
And here it is out there. And yet there is this amazing personality and sense of time standing still in so many parts of that island still.
Mm-hmm. I've always wondered, when I look at all that you've done in your life, it's so extraordinary. But when I think about what's in your mind, and how you've been able to understand and write about almost the whole of Irish history, and also to understand the troubles in the North, and to understand, I mean, you're such a literary man. Where did that come from in your life?
I think it came from storytelling, quite frankly. We lived in a small country parish. My parents were comfortably off. Both of them taught. My father was also a writer. My mother was independently, you know, financially free because her mother was very successful and left her a lot of money. And not a lot of money, but enough to make her independent, so to speak. And to our house came all the people of the parish. And people would come in and they'd sit down. They might be asking my father to write out an application for a grant to build a hay barn or something like that, or to put down a new driveway up to their farm. They might be, the wives might be asking my mother advice on things like crochet and needlework and embroidery. But all of these people told stories. And I was sitting there listening to this. You know, this goes on all over the world, in every community. You have friends there. When you go out to dinner there, if you listen carefully, Kathleen, it's all stories.
Right.
People are telling stories all the time. It might be the story of where somebody's son or daughter is, or somebody's son or daughter recently got married. But we are a narrative species. The human race is a narrative species. And I think that's where it came from. In Ireland, it's kind of intensified by history because it's an ancient tradition. And I heard things transmitted by story all my life since I was a small boy. And then you see the tradition in Ireland was to get everything written down. When St. Patrick came to Ireland and evangelized and converted a whole lot of local young men and taught them to read and write, when they weren't writing or copying out books of psalms and prayers in their monasteries, they were writing out who owns such and such a farm, who owns such and such a farm. They were writing out stories they heard in their childhood. Some years ago, I did a series of public lectures for the University of Connecticut, and the first three lectures were Joyce, Yeats, and Samuel Beckett. The fourth lecture was based on something I started at the Library of Congress several years ago called The Beautiful Bridge. And it's the development of, it shows the beautiful bridge, as I call it, that all these writers crossed from the oral tradition, from storytelling, into literature. Anybody from Ireland who writes comes from that background. Whatever we're doing, we're writing down what we've heard.
Yeah. You, at some time ago, I don't know how when you wrote this, but you you talk about Ireland as being a country that reprocesses itself through the mills of its imagination. But we all do that. We all merge our myths with our facts according to our feelings. We tell ourselves our own story, and no matter what we are told, we choose what we believe. All truths are only our truths because we, too, bring the fact to the facts, our feelings, our experiences, our wishes. So all cultures do that, or do the Irish do that to an exceptional degree?
Very, very few people keep the facts out of a good story the way we do. We do it better than most.
Right.
We're tremendous decorators. You know, I remember my very first piece of journalism ever. I was doing it as a sort of, not so much a student, but summer vacations. And it was a report of a funeral. And there was far more decoration. As the man I handed it to, who was I'm hoping would publish it, said, there was far more decoration in it than there was mourning. And I think we like, listen to Irish music. Irish music is all decoration. There's a main theme. And then people are improvising. It's like jazz. Then people are improvising all the time. And yet somehow, and this is the miracle of Irish music to me always, they all manage to finish together. That is the Irish mentality. We love color. We love personality. We love vividness. We love detail. My mother would not tell you a story without describing every leaf on the tree that the character is walking past. But she would digress. She would go down a side road, and she would tell you a separate story and then come back to the main theme, never losing the main theme.
It's remarkable to be able to do that.
It's wonderful. And a lot of the Irish comedians, if you notice them, they do exactly the same. They will decorate the story to within an inch of its life.
Frank Delaney is our guest on this St. Patrick's Day, and we're welcoming phone calls for him as well. He is a man of many literary talents. He has written best-selling books, starting with Ireland, and the list goes on. We've interviewed him for many of those books. He's been a broadcaster. He's a judge of literary prizes. He has a podcast examining Ulysses. He spent 5 years, and I want to talk to him a bit about this, as a broadcaster for the BBC in Northern Ireland, examining the troubles in Northern Ireland. I'd like for him to give an assessment of where things are now in that country. So, Ireland, a land famous for its storytelling, and we have one of the finest storytellers with us this hour. If you'd like to send a St. Patrick's Day greeting, if you would like to extol the virtues of your favorite Irish poet or playwright or author, we'd love to hear from you, because after all, it's St. Patrick's Day, and we're with Frank Delaney, and it's March 17th. So, here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, @KDunnShow.
A gypsy rover came over the hill, down through the valley so shady. He whistled and he sang till the green woods rang, and he won the heart of a lady. Ah-dee-doo, ah-dee-doo-da-day, ah-dee-doo, ah-dee-day-dee. He whistled and he sang till the green woods rang, and he won the heart of a lady.
And you're listening to our annual St. Patrick's Day celebration. Frank Delaney is our guest this hour. Coming up, Veronica Rickard and Rob Ferret will talk to a historian who shares the difficult road traveled by Irish immigrants in the United States. They'll also learn about Irish dancing in Wisconsin and talk about a top news story of the day. That's Central Time today from 3 until 6. Frank Delaney is with us now. Let's go to a phone call. Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I always think of you as my cousin. We're so alike. I love your show today, and I want to sing the praises of my favorite Irish or Irish-American writers, and that would be Jackie Detloff, my neighbor, and Bill Murtaugh, my partner.
Oh.
And I hope they're listening.
Oh.
Thank you for giving this time to us.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Ellen. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you. Our number is 800-486-8655. I've never seen your series, but I would like to see it. Maybe you can tell me how to. Your series on the Celts, which I believe you did for BBC some time ago, Frank.
I did it about, oh, God, I hate to think how long ago, but it's been shown in 40 countries. Apparently, I sound even more eloquent, as Scott Simon would have it, and he's got to pay for that one day. I sound even more eloquent when I'm dubbed into Burmese. It showed in 40 countries, and you know what's wonderful about it was that it touched so many nerves. When it was shown in Japan, the Japanese sent over film crews and journalists to interview me because the experience, the Irish experience, they said, was so like the Japanese experience.
Really?
With the different islands, yeah. And I found that absolutely fascinating. We basically took the history of the Scots, the Welsh, the Irish, the Bretons, the Manx, the Cornish, the six Celtic nations that are left, that are identified, self-identify as Celtic. And we told the story of where they came from, you know, where they came from with the Ice Age and how they crossed the Alps and how they pushed west, west, west all the time looking for the good land after the last Ice Age melted. But the most interesting thing about it to me was the huge contribution they made to what we call art today. For example, we found flasks and vases that were made sort of 6 centuries before Christ was born.
Oh, my goodness.
That are not only useful, but that are gorgeous. Oh. In the British Museum, there's a set of wine flagons found in on the borders of France and Germany, and the inside screws out so that you can wash it. The outside is a gorgeous-looking thing, decorated with birds and dogs and horses and all kinds of things, and the inside just plops out so that you can wash it out. But you can put it on the table as a wine flagon, and it's just such an ornament. And that's 6-7 centuries before the birth of Christ.
My. So it wouldn't be an overstatement to say that, indeed, they made a major contribution to Western civilization.
Anybody who has got Irish blood in their veins comes from one of the major civilizations of the world, of all time. And that's something to be proud of. And I think that's in part one of the reasons why the Irish civilization has remained so vivid, because it is a long and deep heritage. And we have the right to be proud of what we come from, because we kept it going down the years in the worst possible times. And we managed to continue to be vivid and brilliant and all of those things because of the depths, I contend, because of the depths from which we came. And yes. The depth from which we came was very deep indeed.
Yes, yes, it was. So where does this, you also talk about the Celts having been described probably quite erroneously as barbarian peoples, wild, excitable, ferocious, uncivilized, given to drink, given to song, given to entertainment. You talk about the terrible manifestations of St. Patrick's Day, and a lot of that is associated with drink. Where did we get this idea that's who the Celts were?
Well, there are two things that happen there, and it's most interesting because there's a kind of confluence of ideas. First of all, the word barbarian, in its early days, had a different sort of derogatory connotation, because barbus is a beard, and barbarians were people who didn't shave. So they were these creatures who came in from the hills looking bearded and fierce, huh. And they were called barbarians. But the later reputation of the Irish as a drunken, disheveled, and dirty nation came from the Irish who were made that way through disposition, through dispossession and eviction. Not through disposition, through dispossession and eviction. So we were reduced to being, you know, destitute beyond description, and then blamed for being so.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Let's go to Wayne next in Two Rivers. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. Whenever I think of Ireland, I think of the beautiful mornings with the dew on the grass, especially in the county of Tullamore. And I think when I go home this afternoon, I will have partake a little bit of that Tullamore dew. Say, does Frank know any of the stories concerning the origin of Newgrange?
I do indeed, and I have the novel that I wrote called Ireland opens with a detailed description of the building of Newgrange. Newgrange was built around the year 3200 B.C., It's older than the pyramids of Giza. It's older than Stonehenge. And if you go to Newgrange, you will never forget it for the rest of your life.
No, it's quite a place.
And you walk in there, and you do not see as you walk in that behind you, above the door, there's a wide aperture like a large letterbox. And on the 21st of December, if the skies are clear, and they often are, when the sun clears the far hill, it sends a beam of light through that letterbox along a 62-foot-long passageway to a stone bowl in the middle of a round room at the end of that tomb. And it fills the bowl completely. It looks as though the sun came to earth. And this was done without slide rules, mathematics, computers, set squares or protractors in the year, around the year 3200 BC. Ooh. It is an extraordinary place. What's even more interesting than the structure of the tomb itself is the fact that these people then were sophisticated enough to want to celebrate their dead in that particular way.
Yes.
You're talking about Fred Flintstone's Irish brother, Paddy. That's who you're talking about. And yet,
right.
They did this.
Fred Flintstone's Irish
brother. And his wife, Bridget Flintstone.
Yeah, of course. I knew them well. I always tell people when they go to Ireland, that's where you should start your trip.
That's right.
Don't you think?
That's absolutely the place to begin. And it will hang over you for the rest of the trip, because you will be so amazed by what you have seen.
Yeah.
That you won't ever get over it. Uh-huh. In the best possible way.
Right. Thank
and
you.
They have a simulation of it now. They you can judge what it was like through very, very good reconstruction.
Yes. Thank you, Wayne. Here's a Kathleen Ann. That's my name, by golly, from Milwaukee. Hello, Kathleen Ann.
Hi. It's actually Kathleen and Francis. Now, if that doesn't sound Irish, I don't know what it is.
Oh, I guess you get it all at once, you know.
And I'm loving this conversation so much.
Great.
And I'm only a smidgen Irish, but enough to claim it. A couple of things, one of which is I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Liberia, West Africa, where you could not throw a stone without hitting an Irish missionary, either a nun or a priest. Hmm. And I'd like to ask a question about what it is that he thinks would cause so many Irish people to be called to do this kind of service, and some of them were like the volunteers. In fact, we had an Irish Catholic surgeon nun, Dr. Margaret Chambers, who trained, people forget that Mother Teresa of Calcutta trained as an Irish nun. She was from Albania, but trained as an Irish nun. And we would get letters, we being the collective mission, from Mother Teresa about every 6 weeks. And then the other thing is, my grandfather was more Irish than I, and great-grandfather, and he would tell these stories, which Mr. Delaney has just referred to as being decorated. And this is not a joke, and I don't have a punchline, but with the Irish being known for telling tall tales and stories, how can you differentiate between a tall tale and a story and somebody just lying? And if you're an Irish person, you have to go to confession to say that you've sinned by telling lies when it's just a story.
Why would you want to differentiate if it's entertaining? That's the point.
Absolutely, right.
I mean, as I said earlier, never let the facts get in the way of a good story. You raise an interesting point, and you uncover another interesting point about the missionaries. It's true, it's absolutely true, that the Irish went as missionaries all over the world, as they later went with the United Nations as soldiers, as peacekeepers. So there is this tradition of diaspora in good causes, of going abroad. But, and this is enormously interesting, there is another tradition of Irish migration. And it wasn't voluntary. The Irish were the first slaves in the United States. The Irish were exported en masse, 550,000 of them, in the 1600s by the kings of England to service the plantations in the south, the rivers, the big Dutch estates along the Hudson, and the plantations in the West Indies. Mm-hmm. If you go to places like Mauritius now and Montserrat, you'll find families there with names like O'Connor and O'Keefe and mm-hmm. McGuire and McCarthy, totally local in appearance and skin color, but with Irish names. And in fact, there's the great architect Olmsted, who did Central Park in New York. He wrote a diary of a tour he took to the southern United States in the 19th century. And he describes ships docking in the Mississippi and the crews from Ireland speaking in Gaelic to the dockhands who were Irish slaves.
Hmm. Has anybody done a lot of history of that? Do you know, Frank?
No, I'm doing it at the moment.
Are you really?
I'm working on it at the moment. It's taking a long time.
Yeah,
there's very, very little coverage of it. The whole thing has been obscured and covered over. It is a very, very shameful history.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's going to take a while to get at it.
We were on St. Kitts a couple years ago, and I noticed that there was a very large Irish community on St. Kitts, and I was thinking, what in the world were they doing
that's
there?
That's where it comes from.
That's where it was.
That's where it all started, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. I love, golly, Frank, you can ask you anything, can't you?
Well, remember, hang on a second now. Our caller is talking about the fact that the Irish decorate things and we have to go to confession because we tell lies and things like that. So maybe we should take her word for it and be a bit more careful. I'm joking, of course.
Kathleen Ann, thank you, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you. I must ask about what's happened to the Catholic Church since the sex abuse scandal. I have heard, I haven't been to Ireland in a while, that the numbers in the pews are way down, that it's probably rocked the Catholic Church significantly in Ireland, hasn't it?
The Archbishop of Dublin, a very, very fine man called Dr. Dermot Martin, who has berated the Vatican and his Irish colleagues for covering up really dreadful scandals. Earlier, in the middle of 2013, he came out with a statistic which he had researched himself. He didn't trust anybody else to do it. And this is the statistic he gave. 10 years before he began his researches, the average national attendance at Mass in Ireland was around 88 to 90%. It had fallen to 18.
Woo!
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness.
That's what it's like. Nobody but themselves to blame.
Wow.
Because they lied, they cheated, they covered up, they did appalling things. And, you know, the story of this cover-up hasn't been told fully. It hasn't been told fully in the United States either. And indeed, where you are there, it hasn't been told fully. One day, all of this will come out. There's a PBS documentary at the moment that everybody should see. You'll find it on PBS On Demand. They broadcast it some weeks ago, called Secrets of the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a shocking, shocking indictment of what has gone on. And until such time as these things are acknowledged, and I think the new Pope Francis will begin to acknowledge them, until such time as these things are acknowledged, there can't be any healing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So what replaces the church was such a huge part of life in terms of how you should live, social life, etc. What replaces the church now in Ireland, Frank?
Very interesting evidence of people thinking for themselves for the first time and saying so, saying it out consciously and out loud. People feel very, very cheated. People feel very, very lied to. They feel very manipulated. It's, Kathleen, listen, it's never the crime. People are human. It's always the cover-up.
Mm-hmm.
It's the acknowledgement. It's the failure to acknowledge that it went on. It's the consistent total denial. It's like the cemetery fund where you are up there. It's total consistent denial that anything like this went on. Whereas if people came out like the Pope has done and said, people made dreadful mistakes. Dreadful mistakes were made. We are only human. We beg forgiveness. We're all very forgiving. But as long as the denial continues, the wound won't heal.
Yeah.
And we're a long way from healing that wound.
Yeah. Sally in Middleton. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question, but you won't be able to answer it unless you've heard of the term the Black Irish. Do you know that term?
I presume it has to do with the slavery, has it?
The what?
The slavery.
No.
Tell me what it is.
Tell you the I'm Nellie Burke was my grandmother. I'm Irish. But the story I heard goes way back to Columbus time when European countries were sending out discovery ships. And Greece, there was a ship from Greece that came around into the Atlantic and up the coast and got off the boat where Ireland is and set up colonies there. Of course, they had black hair, and they had a significant number of settlers that are called the Black Irish.
I've heard this term, I've heard it in two respects, one in relation to the slaves, but the other one I've heard it to, in, which is a not dissimilar story from yours. I haven't heard your story, and I'm extremely interested to hear it, but the other story I've heard has got to do with the Spanish Armada,
mm-hmm.
who were attacking Ireland in the 1580s, and the weather caused the ships to founder off the west coast, and the Spanish soldiers came ashore, and they intermarried with the Irish. And if you go to Galway City to this day, you will see people with the sort of the sallow skin, the dark eyes, and the gorgeous black hair. And they are often called the Black Irish as well.
Mm. Thank you, Sally, so much for your call.
Really interesting call.
Yeah. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Frank Delaney is with us. Tipperary-born Frank, man of a vast knowledge of the history, the poetry, the music of Ireland, the Troubles of the North. He's written a number of books, which covers the whole of the 20th century of Ireland, but he's well informed of centuries much, much previous to the 20th century. So his novels, starting with Ireland, trace the extraordinary country and its storytellers. He's been a newsreader for the Irish State Radio and Television Network, a reporter for the BBC in Dublin who covered the violence known as the Troubles. He worked in arts broadcasting for a number of years, created the weekly show Bookshelf, Books and Writers, over the next 5.5 years, and interviewed thousands of important authors, hosted his own talk show. This guy has to host a talk show. I mean, if anybody should host a talk show, it's Frank Delaney, right? You got to have a national show somewhere. He's terrific. He wrote the screenplay for the newest adaptation of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and he is our guest this St. Patrick's Day, as he has been for a few years. We have to pause for a moment. I'm going to play to indulge myself, and because I told you my family is off at baseball spring training, and it's kind of interesting. I make everybody read an Irish poem, and my son, who's in his 20s now, this poem has extra meaning because it's with his father, who's a baseball writer, and that's what my son hopes to be as well. So they're together at spring training, and my son is doing baseball writing now too. So I have to play. I think it's a beautiful poem anyhow, and I love Seamus Heaney, and he died last August, and so we're going to play the digging poem coming out of this pause. Can you preface it for us? Do you want to talk about Heaney at all?
I knew him well.
Did you?
Some of his first interviews.
Did you really?
As a young poet.
Oh,
yeah.
Frank. Oh.
He was very, very profound to talk to. I'll never forget a remark he made to me. We were doing a television documentary. I was doing a television documentary for the BBC about a minor World War One poet from County Meath called Francis Ledwidge. Charming poet. Absolutely delightful writer, but not a great poet like Heaney would become. And I said to him, place him for me. Just place him in the canon of Irish poets. Well, he said, the canon of Irish poets, he said, the giant, the man standing at the top, he said, is Yeats. He said, and here's the difference between Yeats and Francis Ledwidge, he said. Francis Ledwidge, he said, could surf a tide. Yeats could start one.
I love that.
Is that lovely?
Uh-huh. That's lovely. Well, we're going to hear Digging and continue with Frank Delaney and take more phone calls as well. Feel free to join us on this St. Patrick's Day. We have to talk more about the best Irish writings ever because Frank has a list of what you should read. We talked about Ulysses, number one on the list, but there are other Irish novels. And I'm sure some of you have read some of his many novels as well. So join us on this St. Patrick's Day. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're celebrating St. Patrick's Day, which is today on the Ideas Network with Frank Delaney. This is the way I like to celebrate with Frank Delaney in poetry and music. I mentioned Seamus Heaney. We wanted to hear some poetry, and this is Seamus Heaney reading his own poetry, and this poem is Digging.
Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound, when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
Seamus Heaney reading his own work. The poem is Digging. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Neil in Madison is our next caller. Frank, hi, Neil.
Greetings, Kathleen and Frank. I would like to raise the existence of a novel I found very interesting. It's called A Long, Long Way by Sebastian Barry. It's a book appropriate on this centenary of the start of the First World War that deals with the moral quandary that Irish soldiers in the British Army found themselves during the First World War. And it very much mirrors the experience of my own grandfather, who fought in the trenches in 1917 and 1918. And I was curious about if Frank had heard of this novel and could reflect on its meaning. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call.
Neil, that's a terrific thing to raise in the year 2014, the centenary of the start of the Great War. What H.G. Wells, the science fiction writer, called The War to End All Wars. I think it's 250,000 Irishmen signed up on the promise of being given their own government and their own home rule, which, of course, was a promise that was never fulfilled. I know of villages in Ireland, north and south, where all the menfolk died. The carnage was horrific. Mm. The Munster Fusiliers took a hill in France near Armentières, and they lost so many men going up the hill that they didn't have enough men to hold the hill, and they had to come back down again. The Great War in Ireland was a tragic time. My grandfather lost a lot of friends in the Munster Fusiliers, and the Sebastian Barry book does a very, very good job. Sebastian Barry is a fine, somewhat younger Irish writer than I am. He's a fine writer. He's really well worth reading. He's a poet as well, and I sometimes toss a coin to find out which he's better as, a novelist or a poet. But everything he writes has got passion and style and flair and force in it. The whole Great War thing is very, very interesting. I'll give you one tiny insight as to how maybe a writer's, an Irish writer's mind works. When I was a small boy, I was downtown. I was in town one day with my mother in Limerick, what we called it downtown. We went in to see my grandmother. We lived out in the countryside, 24 miles away. And I walked downtown with her. She was doing some clothes shopping for herself. And there was a man standing at a corner, and he had an old soldier's tunic on him and ragged trousers and very broken boots and shoes. And he was leaning against the wall, smoking a cigarette and looking into the distance. And he looked spooky. He looked scary.
Hmm.
He made me shake a little, and I was 6 or 7 years old. So I grabbed my mother's hand. I remember this so vividly. I could show you the corner of the street we were on. I grabbed my mother's hand from the corner of Catherine Street and O'Connell Street, and I grabbed my mother's hand, and I said to her when we'd walked past, who was that man? And she said, oh, he's an old soldier. He was shell-shocked from World War I. As a result of that memory, I wrote an entire novel called Shannon, about a shell-shocked American soldier from World War I who'd been at the Battle of Belleau Wood and who goes to Ireland to find his Irish roots.
Mm.
And that poignancy, that connection, that touching, moving, lost connection, for me, hallmarks the Irish experience in World War I.
So that image, made such an impression that you later wrote on it.
The entire novel called Shannon.
Isn't that amazing, Frank?
Yeah.
And isn't there, what's the other, James Carroll has a book about World War I as well.
There are a number of them. I can't think of them off the top of my head. I'd have to go and look them up. There are a number of them, but it cropped up all the time. The irony was this, Kathleen. England went to war in World War I against Germany, and the line that they used, the line that Lloyd George used, was they were going for the defense of small nations. And here was a small nation on their own doorstep that they had oppressed for eight centuries. And yet they took our fighting men, promising us independence afterwards, a promise they never delivered on.
Yeah.
And we lost 250,000 men or something like that. I maybe it's not as many as that, but I do know that something like 250,000 men enlisted. Now, I don't know what the casualties were. I have this memory niggling at me now that the casualties were not as high as that. There were only 30 or 40,000. But there were villages where the entire male workforce was completely wiped out.
Neil, thanks for your call. Patrick in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Frank. We have a story in our family about our grandfather on my father's side. He was born in Adair, County Limerick.
Oh, I know it well.
And he was able to get a job as a police officer and was transferred to work in Dublin. And this was in the teens of the last century. And apparently one day in 1920, he got an anonymous note on his door as a Dublin police officer that he needed to leave the country right away or he would be killed because all the police were viewed as agents of the British government during the War for Independence.
Hmm.
So I'm just curious about Frank's comments on that and just
that would be
the ramifications and all the echoes from that time period in Ireland today.
That would be spot on accurate. He was a member of the Royal Irish Constabulary. He would be known as an RIC man, and the RIC were hated by the native Republican revolutionary population, which, by the way, was also a minority population because not everybody supported the Easter Rising of 1916, the centenary of which is coming up the year after next. And a lot of the police were targeted, as they were in the recent troubles in Northern Ireland. But in the 19-teens, if this happened to him around 1918, 1919, he was extremely wise to get out of the country because they were killing policemen. And in actual fact, people forget that the Irish War of Independence, which went on from 1919 to 1921, ending in the treaty that divided the country into the 26 counties of the Irish Republic and the 6 counties of Northern Ireland, that began when 2 members of the RSE were shot by a group of Republicans very near my home in County Tipperary. And that was that marked the start of the War of Independence, because the resulting reprisals from the British Army to those killings sparked off a guerrilla war.
Thank you, Patrick, for the call. I'd like your assessment. I know many years ago you reported from Northern Ireland during the Troubles, Frank, as a BBC broadcaster, as a news guy. How would you assess things now? Is there still a great deal of tension?
Did you do science in school, Kathleen?
No.
Okay, well,
why?
Boys did science, I think. In the science lab, we had something called phosphorus, sticks of phosphorus or sulfur. They were kept in jars. I think they were kept in liquid to keep them still, maybe in liquid alcohol or in water to keep them still. If you took phosphorus out and laid it in the open air, there was always the chance it would break into flame again. That's what I think of as Northern Ireland. There's a perfect opportunity coming up in 2016 for the British government to make a great gesture and bring the two sides of Ireland completely together. The physical border is gone. You cannot now find where the two states of Ireland merge, because they remove the physical border, they remove border checkpoints. There is an electronic border, obviously. But the time has come almost for the two sides to come together and make a nation, make a one nation, which is a natural geographic entity, and settle the differences and combine to become an even greater force in Europe than the Irish Republic already is. And it could be done peacefully.
Mm-hmm. Joe in the Dells, hi.
Yeah, hi. I toured Newgrange some years back, and one of the things that struck me, the tour guide, she said, the roof of the inner chamber was the only roof in Ireland that had never leaked. And I was wondering if your guest had any insight into the triple spiral that's found on the big rock out in front.
I've always thought it was a representation of the river that flows down below. The River Boyne.
Okay.
To give you an idea of the antiquity of the Irish and Celtic connections, the Celts are supposed to have come from India. Well, the name of the river down there is the River Boyne, B-O-Y-N-E. It's the most sacred river in Ireland, it was in the ancient legends. And if you break down the word Boyne, it comes out as 2 words, Bo, meaning cow, and An, or Fionn, meaning white. So it could easily be a linguistic representation of the sacred white cow of India. But if you go into Newgrange, on your way into the tomb itself, on your way into the chamber at the end, which is corbelled, it's kind of corbelled building. Corbelling comes from the French word corbeau, a crow. And it's the kind of building where one stone overlaps another the way a crow's upper beak overlaps a lower beak. And the inner chamber is made of corbelling. But on the way in, you'll see all kinds of other little drawings and etchings and scratchings on the stones. And if you look at them closely, you begin to wonder whether they represent the tops of the trees or leaves or things like that, or little whorls and circles like the whirlpools you get in water when there's a current flowing. And it's, you know, as to the roof not leaking, well...
It's a fact.
It's a fact. And remember, Newgrange was hidden for a long time, and now it's got a huge stone roof, and the sod of turf on top of it is several feet thick as well. So if that leaked, we'd all be in trouble.
So give us 2 things that we simply must read during the course of 2014, other than Ulysses.
Go back to How the Irish Saved Civilization.
Okay.
By a man called Cahill, C-A-H-I-L-L, or Cahill, as we call it, good Tipperary name.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best book written about Ireland. And let me see what else. Go back and read Ulysses and follow my podcasts, and we'll all have a great time.
Okay. Oh, I had such a great time talking to you, Frank. Thank you so much.
Oh, Kathleen, it's my pleasure. It's so lovely to do this every year.
I know it is. Thank you. Have a wonderful day, and I'm really interested in the book on Irish slaves, so... Let's do an interview.
I'll keep working.
All right. Thank you, Frank.
Take care.
Frank Delaney lives up to his reputation as the most eloquent man in the world, isn't he? You can just ask him absolutely anything, and there he is with the answer. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Hope you thoroughly enjoy your St. Patrick's Day. I love doing these broadcasts once a year for many, many, many years. Thanks for listening. We have news coming up in just a little while.